We'll start with our blessing. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam asher harbanu mikol hamim v'natan lanu et torato. Baruch atah Adonai notein hatorah. So thank you all for your kind wishes. And my mother-in-law's name was Tova Bat Avraham HaKohen. And what's really beautiful, and I shared this at one of the minyanim out at Shalom Park, is that she passed away on the 17th of Elul. And when Steve, my husband, who's not necessarily one of those interested in gematria kinds of things, I mean, he always is very generous, listens to my saying things, but he came home and said, after we found out she had passed away, we're getting ready to sit down for our Shabbos dinner, he said, I wonder if like a 17 means something, like a 17-something. So I said, yeah, I said, it's the gematria of the word tov, of good. So that she passed away on the good day of Elul, and that her name being Tova, of being good. And she used to not like her name. She thought it was like, I don't know, whatever. She didn't really like her name. I always liked it. So that her name was Tova. And that we know that the first time that the word Tov appears in the Torah is in Bereshit, in creation, that when Hashem looks at each day of creation on the days when he says, and God saw that it was good. And really, I think that encapsulates my mother-in-law, that she passed away, and people say, like, what did she die of? Is she like, she didn't die of anything. She was done. And it was Erev Shabbos, and that we're supposed to say at the end of our week of creating, that we look back on our week and that we see that it was good, that God willing, what we created was good. And that she looked back at what she had done and the family she raised, the husband she took care of, the life she led, and saw that it was good. And she was done and finished. And she said, I want to go home. You know, and then that's what she did. Yeah, I want to go home. And if, 87. And as you know, healthy until 10 days ago. Like, yeah, so it was really amazing. And so said, you know, that Hashem should look at her, that she looked to see that what she had done was good, and that Hashem should see on that day of goodness of the month of Elul that that what she did was good. And that when it's good, which our understanding is good means that it served its purpose, and that we're all here to serve a purpose, and that we're supposed to fulfill our purpose in this world so that at the end of our lives that we can say it was good, and that Hashem can look at us and say that what we did was good. So I just thought it was very fitting and appropriate that she passed away on the 17th of Elul, on that day of goodness, to fulfill the meaning of her name, of Tova, and that she was the daughter of an Avraham, and father was a Kohen, and of course the Kohanim are the people who are entrusted to serve the Jewish people, and just as the Jewish people are the Kohanim for the rest of the world, to serve the world. And she really was that. She was always very proud that she was a Bat Kohen. Steve's father is a Levi, so I always felt like I married into a royal family. My children used to always say, you know, my son's a Levi, my daughter's a Bat Levi, and mom, you're a nothing. But I said, but I am in this family, so that's what I have. So it was really, she was a wonderful person and a wonderful mother-in-law. I think I always felt, since my Hebrew name is Chaya Ruth, that as Ruth, I always kind of felt that I was going to always have a good relationship with my mother-in-law, just like Ruth, even though her name wasn't Naomi. I just always felt like I would have a good relationship with my mother-in-law, and I was very blessed. She always treated me as a daughter, even while Steve and I were dating, which was for 5 years before we got married, that she always really embraced me as a daughter and was very expressive of that. I think the only thing that I did that she really seriously disapproved of, that at least she verbalized, was that I cooked my matzo balls. Either I cooked them with the lid on or off, that it was not the way that one is supposed to make them, and she was like, skeptical that that could possibly turn out, because she was a fabulous cook and baker. And but if anyone wants to know, they actually turn out either way, either lid on or lid off. She says, I don't think they turn out that way. I'm like, they do. So, no, that's not the way you're supposed to make them. So anyway, she was a wonderful person and will be very sorely missed. And we've been very happy to have our family and our communities, all of the communities that everybody's been involved with, really surrounding us. And it's been great. So thank you all for being part of that. Okay, So I'd like to dedicate the learning today should be an aliyah for her neshama. And we're looking at a double portion today of Nitzavim and Vayelech. And we'll begin on page 1087. And these parshas are always read at the end of the year. Always before, we always finish Nitzavim and Vayelech before Rosh Hashanah. So we have the final, even though they're not the last parshas of the Torah, because we still have two more after this. We have Ha'azinu and the Zot HaBracha. So there's two more portions, but they will be in 5775. So the last parshas for this year are Nitzavim and Vayelech, which will be this Shabbos. So there's something about the final portion, the final portions that are being read on the final Shabbos at the end of the year. Because Shabbos itself is considered to be the culmination of our week. And so we have the idea of just this is a culminating time. Everything is coming in, everything is coming in. So one of the ideas that we want to understand, this is from a shiur by Rabbi Ava Wagensberg, is that the idea of bringing everything all together, that the last Shabbos of the year is considered to be an opportunity that we're given to do a tikkun, to correct and improve all of the Shabboses that we have had for this past year. So that however we do this Shabbos, it will act as a correction to retroactively improve backwards in time, which is the beauty of Teshuvah. The beauty of transformation and return is actually a correction in time that where we correct the past. So this Shabbos would be a great opportunity to think of some way to enhance one's Shabbos, because it will retroactively enhance all the ones that previously came before. That being said, is since Shabbos itself is to be a correction, a tikkun on the whole week, that means that since Shabbos is a correction for the whole week, and this Shabbos is a correction for all the previous Shabboses, in a way we have a very, very huge opportunity. This coming Shabbos is supposed to be a correction for every single day of the past year since last Rosh Hashanah, since last year of Nitzavim and Vayelech. So, lest we start hyperventilating and think, oh my gosh, that's a lot, is that a small correction can make a big difference. A small change makes a huge difference. Remember, even in economics, when we would study in microeconomics, we would talk about the different inputs to capital, to production of something. You would have land, labor, capital, and entrepreneurship. I think that's one of the things that we had, land, labor, yeah. And if you make a small change in just one of those variables, it changes everything. So we would like do all this pre-calculator times. We have to do all this hand calculations, how just a small change in the cost of labor would change then whatever, and how many people we could have, and then the price, and then the supply, and the demand. It had like massive ramifications. That was actually my favorite thing, and I think it was from a theological perspective is why I appreciated it. A small change can make a huge difference. So we have a day this coming Shabbos to think about what small change can I make in my Shabbos observance that not only retroactively impacts all the previous Shabboses, but in fact retroactively changes all the past days of this entire year. So that's the benefit of this coming Shabbos, and it's in Nitzavim and Vayelech together. These parshas are very often read together. They're not very long, and in fact, in Parsha Nitzavim, there are only 40 verses, which is pretty short. So if you look, it starts on page 1086, and it goes to page 1092. So there's only 40 psukim in Nitzavim, and you can see, even if you look on the Hebrew side on page 1092, there's some very small writing that's right above the line at the dividing the text from the commentary. So on page 1092, it says there the letter Mem Pesukim, which is the number 40. So there are 40 Pesukim. It says, what do these 40 refer to? So we have to think about, not only are we correcting from the past, and that's what the Shabbos has to offer us, we're also thinking about the future, because that's the whole point of the being in the month of Elul and getting ready for Rosh Hashanah. It's going to be a new year, and we've been getting ready during the month of Elul, starting with Rosh Chodesh Elul. So we know that the shofar is blown, I have to say, having minions in my house every morning, except for scaring the life out of my granddaughter, who's not even one, in the morning to hear a shofar blasting. But it was like really an amazing thing to get to hear that every morning in our house. So we know this time of awakening that started Rosh Chodesh Elul that goes all the way through Yom Kippur. It's 40 days of teshuva, 40 days of return. They're also 40 days of recreation. These 40 days are considered to be an allusion to the 40 days, the first 40 days of a pregnancy. So it's during the first 40 days of an embryo, whatever we want to call it at that time, according to the Talmud, one can pray for a change in the gender of the child. Now, if you're a scientist here and you're like, oh, no, you can't, it's determined, whatever, that may well be, according to our tradition, that the first 40 days things are not so set and there can be changes. So we know that Leah davened when she was first pregnant, that she was originally pregnant after she had her fifth child. Let's see, no, is that right? She had four. Okay, no, she had four when she was pregnant with her fifth child, that then she prayed that it be changed to a girl so that one of her sister Rachel could have the boy. And so that said that prayer, that was not considered a prayer in vain. Because we don't go for praying in vain. You can't, if a house is on fire, you can't pray that it's not your house. Because either it is or it isn't. It's already an established fact. An embryo, the first 40 days is considered water, and it can be changed. So this is 40 days that this is our opportunity for change, that we have an opportunity to be literally reborn, that we can cast ourselves as we wish, and that we can shape ourselves. So instead of at the physical level of determination, at the spiritual level, so just because I was one way for the past X number of years that I've been in this world, this is not determinative of what I become in this coming year. And so during these 40 days, we're supposed to look at ourselves truly as being able to transform ourselves and be born. So those 40 days are parallel to the 40 verses that are in Parshat Nitzavim.
When are the 40 days?
When are the 40 days? Starting with Rosh Chodesh Elul. So we're now at, where are we in Elul? I haven't...
20-something.
Okay, so we have some time left, but the... time to work on that and to really think if you were starting from scratch. So I think, again, since you know I always like to use house remodeling things, there's a difference in what you would consider doing if you were remodeling a place and you were kind of using what you already had and you were limited in what you could do because you're staying in the same place and you have some limitations and, you know, you're not changing your floors, so what are your counters going to look like that will kind of go with your old floors but will look new? You just think about it differently than if someone said, we're going to gut the whole place, what do you want? It's like, oh, what do I want? That's a whole other subject. So remodeling is different than rebuilding from the scratch. So we're considered a scrape-off. If we're considered a scrape-off, we can recreate ourselves. We don't have to say, well, I was shaped like this before, so maybe I could go like that. But we're saying, no, reimagine the whole thing. What do you want to be? So those 40 days are determinative for being able to transform and change. In companion with that, the next parsha that is going, because it's a double parsha, Vayelech, that parsha, and we're going, it starts on page 1095. We're just going to go to the, it's also short. It has, the end of that is on page 12, I'm sorry, on page 1099. And in the Hebrew, on 1098, there's also little tiny letters at the very, before the very last, after the last word of the Torah text, and it says, Ayin Pasukim. So Ayin is the gematria because we write numbers with letters. Ayin means 70. Okay, so is the number 70 is Ayin. So there are 70 verses in the Parsha of Vayelech. It says, what is that equivalent to? It says, that's equivalent to the number of years that we consider are considered like a normal lifespan. Sometimes people say, oh, you know, people, they counted time differently in the Torah and it's all different. It's like, it's no different. 70 years was considered to be an average lifespan. Just like now, it's kind of like you look at how long people live, like 70 years. 70 years, anything after that is considered bonus and blessing. But 70 years is considered great. It says those 70 years are a reference to thinking about the kinds of changes that we want to make, of it being determinative of the all of our time going forward to fulfill our life in this world. That we can transform not just in the moment, but that it can have an impact and can change us for the future as well. through 70 years. That was how long King David lived. He lived to 70 years, and so it's a reference that man's years are 70. And if he's blessed, then 80. So this idea of the 70 years is that we're trying to create a whole new person. And we say, well, but I'm already, 58, so 70, that doesn't leave me so much time left. It's like, you can have the concept of 70, which really means completion, because 70 in and of itself is a product of 7 times 10, bless you. 7, which is always the number of completion, like the 7 days of the week, all are references to 7, and 10, which means full expression. So someone can have complete and full expression that's called 70. It doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be 70 chronological years, because we know some people live many years and they don't achieve what they were really meant to achieve in this world. It doesn't matter how long they're here, they're not doing it. Bless you. And other people have shorter years in this world and they're able to achieve tremendous amounts. So what we want is we want the concept of 70 in our transformation. I want to be able, in the changes that I make in myself for this coming year, to allow me to be able to live a 70 kind of life, meaning a complete and full expression. So that it becomes a symbol of that. Just like we say, may you live to be 120. You'd say, how many people do you wish they should live to 120? And have you ever had that prayer ever answered? Do you know anybody in your personal life who lived to 120? Most of us, I think, not. But what that really means is it's another expression of, can you reach your full potential? Because that's how long Moshe Rabbeinu lived. That's how old Moses was when he died. Interestingly, his brother Aaron was older than him. And we don't use that as the reference. We use how old Moshe was. So it's just kind of interesting that numbers are numbers, but they are also conveying an idea. So the idea of 70 is the idea of complete and full expression. So these parshas at the end of the year, the last parshas for 5774, the last Shabbos of the year, makes a difference in what we're trying to do as far as of transforming ourselves and having results that are going to have a huge impact and allow us to really fulfill our potential. Sometimes it can be depressing and discouraging if we feel like I've had so many years behind me and I didn't get there yet, how am I going to ever get there now? So that's to kind of disavow us of any of those kinds of limitations and free ourselves from that way of thought. The other thing that this parsha represents is the end of Moshe's life. This is the last, we were saying the entire book of Devarim, the entire book of Deuteronomy, is the last month of Moshe's life. Now these parshas, like this is the last day. Okay, this is the very end of Moshe's life. So what we want to look at is we want to look at how does Moshe choose to use the last day of his life? Because that would be instructive. If we could say, like, what should we do? Because sometimes people use that in exercise. If you knew you only had one day left to live, but you had your full health and all of your faculties, what would you do? And that's considered to be a measure of what's really important to you. So if you say, I'd sleep late, I'd have a latte, and it's like, there's not going to be a big novel written about that idea. So there's something, what's a meaningful thing? What would we really do? So we are given instruction from Moshe about what he chooses to do on his last day. So let's take a look at what he does. So first of all, page 1087. And we're going to start with the beginning of Nitzavim. We first just want to get a lay of the land of what's happening here. Kathy, would you like to read starting in verse 9 there, you are standing?
You are standing today, all of you, before Hashem, your God, the heads of your tribes and your elders and your officers, all the men of Israel, your small children, your women, and your proselyte, who is in the midst of your camp, from the hewer of your wood to the drawer of your water. For you to pass into the covenant of Hashem, your God, and into his people to him, and that he be a God to you, as he spoke to you, and as he swore to your forefathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. Not with you alone do I seal this covenant and this
imprecation,
but with whoever is here, standing with us today before Hashem, our God, and with whoever is not here with us today.
Okay. First of all, it's a very long sentence. It says there. Here's actually a long sentence that is broken up in different verses, but there is a long sentence here. Who is Moshe going to be addressing here? Past, present, future, all people, all souls, everybody who's going to come into this world, down to the end of time, that everybody is considered to have been convened. So you may not have remembered attending that meeting, but there was Atem Nitzavim Hayom. You are all standing here today, all of you, down to the future, down to the end of time, till the coming of Mashiach, that everybody was present to hear what Moshe was saying. So this is interesting, because even though we say the Torah is for all time and its lessons are for all time, we don't necessarily say that we were present at all times. We say we were present at Mount Sinai, that all of us were there, and now Moshe is speaking to everybody again, and he's calling all of us present. So the first thing is Moshe's love, care, and concern for all the Jewish people, past, present, and future. And imparting that. So that, of course, is we also think about if somebody has only one day to live, what do you want to do? I want to let everybody know who I love. I love them. I want to tell them of my love and my concern and any guidance or advice or anything else, my living will of what it is I want them to know. So that Moshe is using this as an opportunity to address all the people, not just the people who are there, but everybody past, present, and future. So he's going to go on and address them, and he reinstills the idea of the covenant that the Jewish people have before they cross into the land of Israel. And one of the things that he also does is, hold on, let me just find a page here. I should look at my paper. That would be very helpful. Okay. Is on page 1088. One of the things that Moshe is going to do is he's going to give them a precursor to, not a curse, a precursor, that kind of cursor, a precursor to Jewish history of what's going to happen and about the Jewish people being cast out into exile, which is a very strange message to give people just as they haven't even gone into the land of Israel, and already you're telling me that we're going to get kicked out of the land of Israel and that we're going to be cast out to other nations. But there's a very interesting idea that is connected with this. If you look at verse 26 and verse 27, and let's read that in the English, and then we'll point out something in the Hebrew there. Patricia, would you like to read that?
So God's anger flared against the land to bring upon it the entire curse that is written in this book, and Hashem removed them from upon their soil. With anger, with wrath, and with great fury, and he cast them into another land at this very day.
Okay, at this very day. Okay, he cast them to another land. God is going to send the Jewish people out into exile. If you look over to the Hebrew, even if you don't read Hebrew, you might notice something on that very last line of the Hebrew of the text on page 1088. So look at the Hebrew on 1088, and what do you see? A very big lamed. Okay, that lamed is called a lamed gadol because it is a large lamed. Do you see just the visual of that, the big letter? How did you see the value? Show Teddy the big lamed on page 1088. Okay. Do you see how it's big like that? Okay, it's bold, it's big, and in every Torah scroll, that letter is written super big. Okay, and it's not like a scribal error or something like that. That's part of the understanding of how a Torah is written. First of all, the letter Lamed happens to be the tallest letter in the Hebrew alphabet anyway. And this one comes to be supersized, even bigger and bolder than before. But it's in this word in Vayashlichem, and I will send you, I will cast you out. It's actually from the same word as like Mishloach Manot, Shalach Manas, the treats that we send out to give to other people. Vayashlichem, that Hashem is going to cast them out, but it has this big lamed. So definitely the Vayashlichem has a negative connotation. If you're being cast out into exile, that doesn't sound so good. Bless you. However, it has this big lamed in it, which is understood to be the antidote to being cast out. So the letter lamed, that actually is a word. Lamed is a word. Lilmod, milamed, means to teach or to learn. So why are we being cast out? And what's going to be the antidote that's going to be able to bring the Jewish people back into the land of Israel? Is the Lamed. It's going to be learning and teaching. Because the word for learning and teaching is the same in Hebrew. It's the same word. A teacher is a milamed, and a student is a talmid. But the root is the same. A person who is a sage is called a talmid chacham, a wise learner, a wise student. So there's really no difference. We're all learning, teaching together. It says learning and teaching, that's going to be the antidote to this challenge of dealing with the fact that we have been sent out into exile. We've been sent out into exile because of our shortcomings that we had in the land of Israel. So it's like, okay, I'm going to send you out, but we are taught that the antidote is, the cure is always provided before the sickness, meaning that the antidote is already prepared before the sickness comes. So we have being sent out into exile has been disastrous for the Jewish people. And what's the antidote to it? Learning and teaching Torah. It says, Moshe, what do we call him? When we talk about Moshe, we have one main appellation that we give him. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu, Moshe our teacher. He says, Moshe our teacher. He says, this is what we're connecting to, is that Moshe is looking, what does he want to do? He's telling the Jewish people, the key to bringing ourselves back after being in exile is through learning and through teaching. So some people say, well, I can't really teach anything because I haven't learned enough. It says, not true. There's an obligation. If you know the letter Aleph, you teach the letter Aleph. You know the letter Aleph Bet, you teach the letter Aleph Bet. That whatever we know, we have been fortunate enough to learn, we have an obligation to teach other people. This message is supposed to come to us going into the new year. It's like, how will we transform ourselves? By helping to transform other people. Is there something that I know Jewishly that I can pass on to somebody else? We do not have, this isn't like higher education where you have to have certain credentials before you are qualified to teach other people. In the academic world, you get in big trouble if, you know, some student who just heard a lecture comes into the next class and says, I'm going to tell you now what I just learned, and now I'll be your teacher. It's like, where did you get your degree from? Like, well, I don't really have a degree. I just heard it like an hour ago, and so now I want to share that. So you're like, get out of here. So we are very credential focused in our approach to life, which works really well for a lot of different situations. You really don't want uncredentialed people doing things that could be really risky. However, the credentials for teaching Torah and teaching Judaism are, if you know it, share it. If you know one thing, share it with the people in your life, with a spouse, with a child, with a friend, with anybody. It says that this has been given to us as a mitzvah. We are obligated to do this, and this is what the future of the Jewish people is going to depend on. And it can't wait. As no offense to Lynn, myself, Barbara, it says, the Kiruv organizations cannot do this by themselves. That everybody, every Jewish person is a Mekarev. Every Jewish person is someone who has been empowered to draw other Jewish people close to them, whatever they know, whatever level that they're at. Also, an interesting thing happens is that when you want to share information, you end up learning it much better because you want to make sure you don't say anything that intentionally that's going to be wrong. So that this idea of teaching and instructing is what we're talking about, and that this is what Moshe is going to do on his last day. So how is it that he's going to do this? He's going to do this through the process of writing out the Torah scrolls for all of the tribes. And he does this, it says, on his last day of his life, he writes out 13 Torah scrolls. That's some pretty fast work. Okay, so I don't know how that happened. Very long day. It's a very, very, very long day. I don't know, maybe God stretched out that day for him. But let's take a look at that. We can find the reference here. Hold on 1 second.
That wouldn't necessarily mean last day. It probably means the last part of his life.
You would think so, except that we're told that this means actually his very last day.
Right?
That God said the time has come for you to die, and this is the end, and then he's going to go up to Mount Horeb and die. So this is his last day. And he says in Nitzavim, actually we'll just go across to this, to Vayelech. Let's just skip over to, just for a moment, on page 1095. And Hetty, why don't you read verses 1 and 2? That will give us our information right there.
Moses went and spoke these words to all of Israel. He said to them, I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in, for Hashem has told me, you shall not cross this Jordan.
Okay. All right. This is his last day. I'm 120 years old today. And we know that Moshe was born and died on the same date of the 7th of Adar. He was born on the 7th of Adar, and he died on the 7th of Adar. So he died on his birthday. So this was his last day in this world, is when he wrote the Torah scrolls. Susan. Ah, 12 for each of the tribes and one to go into the ark, so that there would be a master copy to be preserved for copying. So it says, originally he only did one, and that the other tribes that were like, what about us? So that's the Midrash fills in that there were 12 others and that he wrote them all out for, so that everyone could have, and that they didn't want to be left out of that. But the text specifically says he wrote the one scroll and gave it to the Kohanim and the Levim, because the Kohanim and the Levim were in charge of teaching the Jewish people. The other tribes were like, we also want. So that was considered a tremendous merit on the part of the Jewish people, that they weren't like, okay, you be the teachers, we'll be the students. Like, we are all the teachers. We are all the teachers of Torah. Lynn.
I guess this is a longer discussion that we have today, but so it's written in a rule, and it's all about Shiva. And so we are taught that everything, it's possible to do Shiva for everything.
Yes.
Except for Moses is being punished.
So that is a bigger conversation. So they're saying that he wasn't meant to go into the land of Israel, and that he was a man for the Yetziat Mitzrayim, Exodus from Egypt, and being the 40 years in the desert, that everybody has their place and their time they were designated for. And it was almost as if that God almost had to find an excuse to have something to hang his hat on to not have him go in. Because we know that in Parsha, I think it's V'etchanan, that Moshe prays, whatever the gematria is of V'etchanan, that Moshe prayed that many times to God to let me in, let me in, let me in, let me in. And God said, stop asking, not I'll smack you, is stop asking, otherwise I'll have to let you in, and it won't be good for you.
But he's pleading on our behalf. You know, he's pleading on our behalf, you know, to be forgiven for the golden calf.
Yes.
And like he could not make right. Did he do a
teshuva? So he did, and his teshuva is actually interesting. That's what this is. Though it was different. Even with the teshuva, it was not his time. And God even shows him the whole history of the Jewish people unfolding until Moshe understands that was not his time or place. So Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam were meant for the Exodus from Egypt, period. The gematria of their names, Moshe, Aharon, Miriam, equals Yetziat Mitzrayim. It's like, that's your job description. He couldn't go in anyway. So even with Teshuvah, he couldn't go in anyway.
There's no hopeless case
on our plate. But there are things, you know, I can be davening all I want. I'm not going to be living in the year 20, you know, whatever. It's not my time. So it's actually funny, just being like my mother-in-law, she always said, I was born in the wrong generation, because she had no use for computers. I was born in the wrong generation. I'm not touching it. I don't touch it. So then it was P.S., you know, asked my father-in-law, tell me what the kids wrote in their emails, but like, I'm not touching it. So there is a time and place for everybody, and there's a boundary. That's a huge, wonderful discussion that we could have about Moshe. From this perspective, what Moshe is looking actually to correct is he is looking to correct another sin. He is looking to correct a sin, and now just put your string here. So first of all, Hetty, hopefully that answers your question you had about, was it the end of Moshe's life generally? We're talking about the actual day. Now, obviously this is hard for us to comprehend because it takes a year to write a Torah scroll. So how is that possible? It's like, I don't know. Maybe the quills like wrote themselves. I have no idea. It's just considered part of our tradition that they were written
but
on the last day.
God made that day last.
God may have made that day last a really long time. Don't you have some days until you're done? And sometimes God can stretch time. You know, time is not as static as we tend to think of it as. Of being a scientist, have shown that time is not the same. Maybe from Moshe's day opened up in a way for him that it was longer. I don't know. But it was that he was on his day. We're going to come back to that because the whole thing, because we know the holiday of Purim is in the month of Adar, and there's a whole reason why Haman was excited when he cast lots and it fell on the month of Adar, why he thought that was going to be an auspicious time to annihilate the Jewish people, and it turned out to be an auspicious time for the Jewish people to come and return and do teshuvah and get back on track. But before we go to that, let's go to Shemot, to Exodus, and I want to look at, I have the Hebrew, so I don't, let me get the page. It's chapter 4, verse 1. I'm sorry?
You know, there are not enough certain things. What's it called? Mystical realism? Magical realism?
Mm-hmm.
So now I have this energy question. On the last day of his life, with the intention of writing a Torah for all the tribes plus one, he writes the first letter.
Uh-huh.
And the first letter magically becomes 13 Torah.
I can see that. Well, even because, you know, I think of like lots of magical ways that could have happened too, of like it unfolded. So each one gave birth to itself because it's really all the name of God. You know, the Torah, it could just like expand. Things can happen quickly. I had a fun opportunity when my grandchildren were here. We were at the Botanic Gardens and they had something in the youth gardens from Chipotle, which it's not usually something that's in my home from there, but it was tomato plants. So they gave you a container, the seeds, and this disc, which I didn't even realize was dirt. I thought, I can't believe they're giving out to kids a dish, a plant, a pot, and seeds, and there's no dirt. That means I have to go find some dirt that's good for tomato plants? Like, where am I supposed to get the dirt? So then, like, out of the package falls this little disc that looks like nothing. And I'm like, oh, I wonder if this is the dirt. So we put a drop of water on it, and it starts, and it filled the whole pot. I'm like, oh, my God, that was the most exciting thing. So maybe it's just like, you know, the first drop of the ink, maybe just the whole Torah just unfolded from that first letter, and who knows? Anyway, that was very exciting. And then we planted the seeds, and on one day, the seed went from being like a little pokey thing, just barely coming out of the dirt, to a 3-inch sprout. I'm like, how did this happen? How did this happen? I didn't see it. I was at home the whole time. I didn't see it. So things can grow and expand. We don't know how it happens. Okay, just out of the side. Yes, Pam.
Well, I'm just thinking in today's world with computers, if God had written the Torah to give it to Moses, it would be a file. And you say all Moses would do is
like download, click, copy, copy, copy.
No, but he would just click and from that file,
it would.
All of a sudden it's there.
There you can have it.
Just duplicate.
I
mean, I'm just saying, if everything is supposed to have always been.
So your metaphor is wonderful. We have one thing our metaphor requires one piece, little change, which is that Moshe writing it. He has to go through the process of writing it for this very specific reason. And we're going to see that reason based on what we're going to see in Shemot. So if we go to chapter 4, but I like your idea. I think that's for the future. That may be how it's going to be done. Yes, chapter 4, verse 1. And that is on page 307. Thank you. Chapter 4, verse 1. And Pam, actually, why don't you read verse 1 there?
Moses responded and said, "But they will not believe me, and they will not heed my voice, for they will say, Hashem did not appear to you."
Okay. I know this is a little bit out of the blue here, but what is it that we're talking about? Can you guess what this is? What is Moses talking about?
When he talks to the Egyptian.
Yes, but who is he concerned is not going to believe him?
Pharaoh.
The Jewish people. Yeah, the Jewish people. It's like, they're not going to believe me that God sent me to liberate them. And that is considered a sin on Moshe's part for not having faith in the Jewish people. I'm sorry?
Or in God.
But in this case, it was actually the faith in the Jewish people, because it says, Vehein, lo ya'aminu. They're not going to believe me about you. And it's not they don't believe in God. They're not going to believe the I'm that you sent me, that this is going to end. This phrase opens up in the Hebrew. It doesn't come across in the English, where it says, Moses responded and said, but they will not believe in me. In the Hebrew, it says, Vaya'an Moshe Vayomer, and Moshe answered him and said, Vehein, lo ya'aminu. Vehein, and behold, they will not believe me. And God felt that that was a dig at the Jewish people. And God is the protector of the Jewish people. And so Moshe is called to task for that. So now, go back to where we were. And we're actually going to go to where, we need to where God is going to tell Moshe that it's time for him to pass away. Page 1097. Let's see. Verse 14. So let's take a look at verse 14 on page 1097. And Susan, would you like to read that?
Hashem spoke to Moses, behold, your days are drawing near to die. Summon Joshua, and both of you shall stand in the tent of meeting, and I shall instruct him.
Okay. That phrase opens up, Hashem spoke to Moses, and in this case, the word behold is in the English, and the Hebrew is hein, behold. Karvu yamecha lamut. Behold, your days are drawing near to die. Bless you. So we don't need the word behold. Like, do you have to really say that to someone? Behold, your days are coming. I mean, it's like a Shakespeare. Behold, hark, I hear them coming. But the Torah doesn't need like that kind of drama. So it says it's an allusion to the word hein, where the last time it was, Moshe used the word hein when he said, the Jewish people are not believers. They're not going to believe in you, God. They're not going to believe in me. They're not going to believe in this whole thing. God is like, don't say that about my beloved Jewish people. Hein, that your time, behold, now your time is coming to die. And it's a little hint to him with, let's correct that problem of your little bit of lack of belief in the Jewish people. Now, actually, that kind of addresses the whole issue with Moshe being punished for striking the rock, because some commentaries say it wasn't as much striking the rock as that he said to the Jewish people, behold, you rebels. And he called them a name, a not nice name. And God was like, don't talk to my people like that. It's like parents can talk to their children, like, but don't have some other person telling them, you know, that's my child you're talking to. Now, the parent may go and, like, smack them upside the head when they get them home, but don't you be saying that. So Moshe was considered very out of line for calling the Jewish people rebels. So God is saying, okay, you have your last day here. What are you going to do? God doesn't tell him, write the Torah. Moshe's going, like, write the Torah. I'm going to write the Torah. So what does it mean to write the Torah? So we know that we have the phrase that there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. 600,000 letters of the Torah, what else are there 600,000 of? The Jewish people, the Jewish root souls. There are 600,000 main souls of the Jewish people. We all really come from one source, but we have 600,000 root souls with tributaries and sparks coming off of them that we all are sharing. So we say to write a Torah. It says writing the Torah was an effort to attach himself to the souls of the Jewish people, of all of the neshamas, of all of the souls that were present then and that would be present before, that were present before and all the way into the future, to invest himself into their neshamas. So we even have that the name of the Jewish people, which is Yisrael, that is considered an acronym for a phrase, Yesh Shishim Ribu Otiot LaTorah, which means there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. So that says that Yisrael, which has a lot of different ways of understanding what that means, is understood to be an acronym for Yesh Shishim Ribu Otiot LaTorah, the Yud for Yesh, the Shin Shishim, the Resh Ribu Otiot, the Aleph, and the Lamed LaTorah. So there are 600,000 letters in the Torah. But the Jewish people are called another name. You can see it throughout the writings. We're also called Yeshurun. If you have the synagogues, they're called B'nai Yeshurun. Okay? So that is like, who's that? Who's the Yeshurun? So Yeshurun is another name for the Jewish people, and that's considered an acronym that's very similar to Yisrael, as Yeshurun, is Yesh Shishim Ribu Nishamot LeYisrael. So that there, I'm sorry, I got those mixed up. I didn't write it. Oh, Yesh Shishim Ribu Nishamot. There are 600,000 neshamas. So the 600,000 neshamas, 600,000 letters. Writing each letter is investing in the neshamas of the Jewish people. It's not just the writing, the letters. It says studying the Torah, studying the letters of the Torah, that when a Jewish person invests themselves in the studying of the Torah, they are actually strengthening the souls of the Jewish people, that it has an impact on the people, the Jewish people. So you may think, oh, I looked at the Parsha and I read a little bit of Hebrew, I studied it, that you can study it and learn at that level. Some people approach it in an intellectual way, which is interesting but inadequate. There are others like, what's the spiritual meaning for me? Even better. The next is to immerse myself in the letters of the Torah. So it's very interesting. I don't think there's a book of Psalms here. In many books of Psalms, there's a blessing that is recited. Actually, is there a Siddur up there?
So what are we doing? What level is this?
Is store this part? Depends which intention you come in with it. If you come in with the intention of this, my Torah reading, my Torah study, thank you, is not just for me, but is also to strengthen the Jewish people. Because I want it, and it gets all tied together. I want to learn, because that will strengthen the Jewish people, and then I will manifest that actual strengthening through sharing Torah with somebody else, of feeling entitled to and given the command, go forth. God is appointing you, like as if you were the last person on earth. I remember when I taught, let me just look for this a moment, when I taught Bar and Bat Mitzvah students, which was a very wonderful thing to be able to do, one of the things that I told my students is, I am teaching each one of you, no memorizing this stuff. You're going to learn it. It's going to take longer, but it will be better. You're going to learn how to read it. You'll learn the cantillation, the melodies. You're going to learn this because I need to teach you as if you were the last Jewish person that I would ever meet. If you know that somebody is being entrusted with the legacy, you can't afford to be slipshod about it. You can't be like, oh, you know, Leah, I'm teaching 400 people, so yeah, I'll take a little bit, like whatever, just kind of casually get it done and have it be a non-experience. Not only is it cheating the person, but our legacy, our inheritance gets handicapped that way. It's like, what kind of inheritance is that? It has to be transmitted. So to transmit something from one person to the next is a huge responsibility and an obligation, and we're supposed to take that seriously. We take the letters seriously, even the writing of the Psalms. So there's a prayer that we say before we recite Psalms, and we ask that there should be, that's not translated here, so let me just find it here. It says that we should have the merit of the and the zechut of the tevotehem, which means the merit of their of the words, the otiotehem, from the word ot, which are the letters, and the vowels and the cantillation symbols. It's like, what does that mean? It means that all of these things are not just letters on the page, and talk about magical, mystical, beyond our comprehension. We're talking about this as being the spiritual code for the existence of the Jewish people, and our engaging with it is what strengthens the Jewish people. It strengthens us as individuals. It strengthens those that we teach and share with. One thing, one little iota of something brings strength to the Jewish people. And that's what Moshe was being involved in. It wasn't like, oh, let's see, this is the last day of my life. What should I do? I think I'll sit down and write 13 Torah scrolls. I mean, that's very amazing, but you wouldn't necessarily think that that would be the best use of his time, even. It says, what did he do? He actually went out to each tent to visit every single Jewish family to give them personal encouragement, and he wrote the Torah scrolls. I'm like, that was one long day. But what it's saying is, what was he compelled to do? He was compelled to strengthen and connect and impart wisdom to the Jewish people. That's what he wanted to do with his day, his last day. So we're coming to our Shabbos, of our last parsha of the last day of the year that we're coming to. It's like, what do we want to do with our last day? We want to do what Moshe did. And it's wonderful to have Shabbos. Shabbos is a great opportunity. You know, invite somebody over. Call them before Shabbos. Give them a little bit of Torah. You know, I learned one thing. You know, what was it? And to share it with somebody else. And that is what we are commanded to do. There's interesting language that talks about how Moshe really got to reach all of the Jewish people. And it's in the very last word on Parsha Vayelech, which is on page 1099. Verse 30. Here, Diane, would you like to read that for us?
Moses spoke the words of this song into the ears of the entire congregation of Israel until their conclusion.
Okay. What phrase seems unnecessary?
Until their conclusion.
Mm-hmm. Until their conclusion? What does that mean?
Forever and ever.
So you could say, what is until their conclusion? You'd say
until they died.
Until they died from. So it could be
till their
conclusions. So you could say Moses spoke the words until he concluded all his words, but you would expect Moshe to speak all of his words until he finished all of his words. So of course he would conclude his words. This is understood to mean it's the word is, it doesn't say ad hasof. It doesn't say until the end. It says ad tumam. So the tumam means there tmimut. So the word to be tam means to be whole and complete. Okay, like that is the idea of that we're whole and complete. How long did Moshe talk to them? Until the Jewish people were complete. What does that mean? That they were fully affected by what he was saying. It wasn't like, you know, when is this drasha going to be over so we can get to Kiddush? It was, I'm talking to you and I'm going to impart to you until you are transformed. And that will be, that's that level. He spoke until their conclusion, the conclusion of the people, till they became Tom. That's one level of understanding it. The other level is that he spoke ad tumam, until their conclusion, meaning when is the Jewish people really complete? Not in any one generation, but not until the 6,000 years of this world's plan, until the coming of Mashiach, until the end of days, down to what we are considered now, that we are in the days of coming of Mashiach. The things in this world are frazzling and fraying at all ends, and I have to say, it can only get better. I don't want to say it can get worse, because I don't want to even see what that would look like. We are in these final days, and what we need to do and what we're trying to live with is the inspiration that comes from the Torah that we actually received at this time of Parsha Nitzavim and Vayelech. And it says, until their conclusion, until the Jewish people conclude their journey through history and the people and the world is transformed, that's the transformation. How does this get affected? In a very interesting twist on a Gemara in the Talmud, going back to Purim, says that Haman was very excited that when he cast lots that the month of Adar came up, because he knew that Moshe had died during the month of Adar. So that must be like not such a good time for the Jewish people. That would be an auspicious time to bring them to an end, just like Moshe was brought to an end. But the Gemara says Haman did not know that Moshe was also born on the 7th of Adar. How we always understand this is that, yes, he was born on the 7th of Adar. But says that's not what it's talking about, his original birth. It was talking about a rebirthing that happened on the day of his death. That he died on the 7th of Adar, and on that same day that he died, that his neshama kind of burst into 600,000 sparks of little neshama and impact into all of the souls of all the Jewish people that would ever live. And then when someone is studying Torah, they are accessing their spark of Moshe that is in them. And specifically when they teach. We said before, who gave me permission to teach anything? I'm not a teacher. It's like, yes, you are. Moshe ensured that every Jewish person would have that spark of Moshe Rabbeinu in him or her to be able to teach Torah. because it is only the teaching and learning of Torah that is going to be the antidote to bring the Jewish people and the whole world to its perfection. Otherwise, it's a cruel joke. Okay, I'm leaving. Goodbye and good luck. I hope you all were listening. But that's only as good as the generations that heard. How does that help anybody? So it says that Moshe imparted, not just at an intellectual level, but at the soul level, imparted his neshama. And that's what Haman didn't know. He didn't know that the Jewish people had the power to reconnect with the Torah, which it says that that's what they did. That was the teshuvah that they did in Persia that enabled them to be saved through Queen Esther. That was the kind of the storyline, but it took the teshuvah of the entire Jewish people reconnecting and recommitting to Torah. That's what saved us. How did that happen? It's like they all got in touch. They said, Haman didn't know that on the day that Moshe died, which was the 7th of Adar, he was also reborn into the Jewish people, and that they had a point of access that they could touch upon. Susan.
Well, it's so touching because it's so much more meaningful because he didn't believe that he could be a teacher.
Right. He was the one like, I can't talk. I'm this, I'm that. It's like God's like, I've had enough of you.
Now I'm going to let you.
That's right. That's a very good point. Beautiful point. It's like, if he can do it, I can do it. I mean, I have to say, I remember when we were members of Road of Shalom, and I learned how to lane Torah. There used to be a man, a little old man from Europe who read Torah. And I seriously used to think that you had to be a little old man from Europe in order to read Torah. That was like kind of like went with the package. After he passed away, there were no Torah readers, and so like a small cadre of us learned how to read Torah. So I did it and loved it. It was wonderful. I love, love, love doing that. But I remember people coming up to me, like a kiddish, afterwards saying, well, I'd like to learn it because I figured if you could learn it, I could learn it. And I know they meant it as that they could relate. Like, well, if you could do it, I could do it. And that is the truth, that that's how the Jewish people are. We do not have a division between the teachers and the students. The students are the teachers. That is who we're talking about. And we have all been empowered, and not just like give you authority. It's no good to be given authority to do something if you don't have any ability to do it. So this is saying, you have the ability, you have the authority, and that lamed, that big lamed of teach, 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 that's the beacon, the tall beacon that's like a lighthouse that is going to be the beacon to bring the Jewish people home and back home in every single way of reattaching to their inheritance that is going to be the antidote to being flung out. So God willing, as we think about during the 40 days of Elul, of how do I recreate myself? I can change what I thought. If I can go this kind of nothing too much more basic than gender of in identity, it's like, how can I become something else? This is not a remodel. It's a scrape off. We're starting all over. We have 40 days. We are water. We can change. Teshuva is always associated, actually, with water because water flows and it takes the shape of whatever container you try to put it into. Unless it's frozen, it takes the shape of whatever you pour it into. What do you want that shape to look like? Your neshama will adapt to take that shape. We're trying to do that. We want it to affect our 70-year life. We want to have a 70-year life where we can be complete, where we can have full expression. 7 of completion, 10 of full expression. We want a 70 kind of life, no matter how many actual chronological years we are endowed with. And we want to understand that Moshe spent his last day pouring his heart and soul into making the souls of the Jewish people as strong as possible by engaging with each letter, engaging with each neshama of the Jewish people, not just the ones who were alive then, but for all of you, the ones who are here today, the ones who are not here today, who are yet to be until the end of time, until everything is tam, that the last word of the very last word in the Torah that we say before Rosh Hashanah is the word complete. So nothing could be more complete than to use the word complete as the completed version of the Torah. We're talking about complete. So we have this huge opportunity, this funnel of spiritual time that is coming down into this Shabbos for us to reflect on that. God willing, we will take that opportunity, really run with it, and see what we can create in ourselves. We will not obviously have class next week because next week is Rosh Hashanah, and hopefully everybody is enjoying their recreation, and I hope I recognize you when you come back after the next week. We will meet on the Thursday between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, so that we'll have a chance to share more Torah then.
So can you give us a couple examples of the scrape?
Of the scrape-off?
Yeah. That's,
Let's that. Talk, just since I know some people need to go, and then we'll talk about what the scrape-off is. Basically, means, but the basic idea is that you don't have to be stuck in what you were in the past in order to be something new in the future. That just because you did something for, you know, 50 years a certain way, or had a certain belief, or a certain whatever, does not mean that you have to continue on. And it doesn't have, it can be a change. It can actually be a change. It's hard to see ourselves as being that changeable because we have somewhat of a rigid perspective of who we are. And so this is to break free of that so that we can go beyond those boundaries of self, of identity.
Like, give me an example.
Well, I'll give you an example. When I started to cover my hair, I decided, I was went through a whole thing about that. No, even when I just changed how I dressed. I went to talk to a rabbi, not even in town, because I didn't want to talk to somebody here because maybe they have a preconceived idea of what I should be doing. And I was so concerned about what people were going to think. Like, and there were two people in the community who had issues with what I did. Someone, it was when I actually started to wear to cover my hair. She said to me, "What's that supposed to mean?" You know. And one person said, "I can't really learn with you anymore because now you look like one of those, and I can't relate." And that's what I was afraid of, you know. So I was like, "Okay, I need to do something different that reflects my true calling to what I'm hearing for myself as my next step." But it was like I was scared to do it. It was like, "Okay, I'm doing it." And but it takes courage to do that because you recast yourself, and sometimes we're afraid not only of what other people are going to say. What am I going to say to myself? It's like, am I being a faker? I'm phony. You know, that's not really who you are. It's, you know, why are you doing that? I know people who, somebody who wanted to go to the mikvah, but they didn't keep kosher, and they felt that they were being hypocritical. Like, well, if I don't keep kosher, then I don't really have the right to go to the mikvah. I'm like, the mitzvot are not, there's no prerequisite. They all stand alone. All of them stand alone. Each one stands alone. And they got themselves into a spiritual bind because they had identified this, I am this, ergo, I can't do that. Or, I've never done that, so therefore, it's not really possible for me to. We get ourselves all bound up. When we come to Kol Nidre, when we say all vows, part of that is like, I haven't taken any vows. It's like, oh, we take vows to ourselves all the time, and we define who we are, and it's as if we made a vow that, God forbid, we should change because this is who I am. It's like, you don't have to be that way. You can change anytime you want to. So it's to really free ourselves and say, let it happen. So that's the scrape-off. Not just like, okay, you have brown floor, so now we're really stuck with what kind of counter looks good with the brown floor. It's like, you don't have to have a brown floor. Start over. What do you want? What do you want it to look like? And start with that. And the first small thing, and as I remember Irma Bombeck, she said she bought a new kitchen towel and she ended up remodeling her whole house. Because once you start, you just pick one little thing to change and it triggers everything else flows from that. So don't even worry about the wall. Just buy a new towel. Get a new towel and just see where it takes you. I love that, and it's so true.
I just wanted to say something really quick, is that you were talking about the legacy and the neshama, and how we, as if each of us is the last Jewish person on earth. And so I told you that this weekend I had like a celebration of my bat mitzvah.
Yes.
Right. To make a fresh start for myself. So I invited my non-Jewish friends, and they were like, wow, it like, there's people up and down and kissing and carrying and opening and shutting, and there's people all around the bima or the bima. Right. And
the shulchan, the table.
And they said that model is so different than the Christian model where there's one person up there and everybody else is down here. And I said, you don't need a rabbi and you don't need a synagogue. You just need the people.
You just
That's
need Jewish people.
Model.
That's our model.
I know, and they were like,
Wow.
Like, we are all expected to be learned and to be able to participate.
That's right.
And I was really scared, because I haven't read Torah in 45 years, that I wouldn't, like, I don't remember the tropes. Like, I remember.
Yeah, but you were afraid.
Inside me, but I couldn't look at the sim. So the amazing thing, she talked about magical realism. The letters, like, were telling me what to say.
I totally hear.
The letters were telling me. I mean, I studied very hard.
But
the letters
they sing out.
They were like telling me like where to go. That just blew my mind. And then the Gabbai said, I don't really know him. Like, I mean, he's seen me as, he said, you're going to do great. And like, our model is that we coach each other.
We are.
Helping each other.
Yeah.
And it was like, I told my friends, I said, if I get stuck or I make a mistake, just so you know, it's not an embarrassment.
Yeah.
It's to respect the holy text.
That's right.
And they're going to stop me.
They'll stop. They'll correct you.
And I will start again. And they will whisper in my ear. I said, but don't be embarrassed for me. And
it's okay.
It's not a shame that it happens.
Yeah.
Thank God it didn't happen. But it was so beautiful, like, because they were non-Jewish, they could reflect to me through their eyes.
Right.
What our model is.
Our model is. Well, we've had people come to the Dot Minyan, like for a Simcha, like non-Jews, and they'll say, someone's like davening Shacharit, they'll say, is that the rabbi? I'm like, no, that's just like a person. Like, and then the next person gets like, is that the rabbi? I'm like, no. Like, well, where's the rabbi? I'm like, well, he's sitting over there, you know, like davening with everyone else. It's like, we don't have any difference. Unless you're a Kohen or a Levi and the temple is standing, we all are in the same boat together here. We're all
and then when
power.
They say Yeshua,
yeah,
and then,
go strong and straight.
And it just, they were
go
just
straight
like
and
so,
strong.
Yeah,
that's our model. And that Yesher Koach to all of us, and really Chazak, Chazak, Venit Chazek, which we say at the end of the actual Sefer Torah, but really should be a good, strong year. And we should all just make the next step in our journey and just be there to help and inspire and encourage everybody else around us. And we help each other. You know, you teach me this, I teach you that. It's all a communal thing. The Torah, if one letter is missing, it's not a Torah. You cannot use the Torah. One letter is missing, it doesn't count. We're waiting for all of the souls of the Jewish people to come home. So God willing, we will. All right. Have a wonderful, wonderful Shana Tova Tikateva with Tichatemu. We should be inscribed and sealed in a good and sweet year.
Do you mind saying that the one phrase you just said, the Zakhira today?